Chapter 30. Commanded by the derelict shade of Jorgensen could be heard outside. Jorgensen, on taking up his dead command, had a house of thin boards built on the after deck for his own accommodation, and that of lingered during his flying visits to the shore of refuge. A narrow passage divided it in two, and Lingard's side was furnished with a camp bedstead, a rough desk, and a rattan armchair. On one of his visits, Lingard had brought with him a black seaman's chest, and left it there. Apart from these objects and a small looking glass worth about half a crown, and nailed to the wall, there was nothing else in there whatever. What was on Jorgensen's side of the deckhouse, no one had seen, but from external evidence one could infer the existence of a set of razors. The erection of that primitive deckhouse was a matter of propriety, rather than of necessity. It was proper that the white men should have a place to themselves on board, but Lingard was perfectly accurate when he told Mrs. Travers that he had never slept there once. His practice was to sleep on deck. As to Jorgensen, if he did sleep at all, he slept very little. It might have been said that he haunted, rather than commanded, the Emma. His white form flitted here and there in the night, or stood for hours, silent, contemplating the somber glimmer of the lagoon. Mr. Travers' eyes, accustomed gradually to the dusk of the place, could now distinguish more of his wife's person than the great mass of honey-colored hair. He saw her face, the dark eyebrows and her eyes that seemed profoundly black in the half-light. He said, "You couldn't have done so here. There is neither lock nor bolt." "Isn't there? I didn't notice. I would know how to protect myself without locks and bolts." "I am glad to hear it," said Mr. Travers in a sullen tone, and fell silent again, surveying the woman in the chair. "I indulge in your taste for fancy dress," he went on with faint irony. Mrs. Travers clasped her hands behind her head, the white sleeves slipping back bared her arms to her shoulders. She was wearing a Malay thin cotton jacket, cut low in the neck without a collar, and fastened with wrought silver clasps from the throat downward. She had replaced her yachting skirt by a blue check sarong embroidered with threads of gold. Mr. Travers' eyes, traveling slowly down, attached themselves to the gleaming instep of an agitated foot from which hung a light leather sandal. "I had no clothes with me, but what I stood in," said Mrs. Travers. I found my yachting costume too heavy. It was intolerable. I was soaked in dew when I arrived. So when these things were produced for my inspection..." "By enchantment," muttered Mr. Travers in a tone too heavy for sarcasm. "No. Out of that chest. There are very fine stuffs there." "No doubt," said Mr. Travers. "The man wouldn't be above plundering the natives." He sat down heavily on the chest. "A most appropriate costume for this farce," he continued. "But do you mean to wear it in open daylight about the decks?" "Indeed I do," said Mrs. Travers. "The Delcasser has seen me already, and he didn't seem shocked." "You should," said Mr. Travers, "try to get yourself presented with some bangles for your ankles, so that you may jingle as you walk." "Bangles are not necessities," said Mrs. Travers in a weary tone, and with the fixed upward look of a person unwilling to relinquish her dream. Mr. Travers dropped the subject to ask, "And how long is this farce going to last?" Mrs. Travers unclasped her hands, lowered her glance, and changed her whole pose in a moment. "What do you mean by farce?" "What farce?" "The one which is being played at my expense." "You believe that?" "Not only believe. I feel deeply that it is so. At my expense." "It's a most sinister thing," Mr. Travers pursued, still with downcast eyes and in an unforgiving tone. I must tell you that, when I saw you in that courtyard in a crowd of natives and leaning on that man's arm, it gave me quite a shock." "Did I too look sinister?" said Mrs. Travers, turning her head slightly toward her husband. "And yet I assure you that I was glad, profoundly glad, to see you safe from danger for a time at least. The guy in time is everything." Dot, I ask myself. Mr. Travers meditated aloud. Was I ever in danger? Am I safe now? I don't know. I can't tell. No. All this seems an abominable farce. There was that in his tone which made his wife continue to look at him with awakened interest. It was obvious that he suffered from a distress which was not the effect of fear, and Mrs. Travers' face expressed real concern till he added in a freezing manner, the question, however, is as to your discretion. She leaned back again in the chair, and let her hands rest quietly in her lap. Would you have preferred me to remain outside, in the yacht, in the near neighborhood of these wild men who captured you? Or do you think that they too were got up to carry on a farce? Most decidedly. Mr. Travers raised his head, though of course not his voice. Why, you ought to have remained in the yacht amongst white men, your servants, the sailing master, the crew whose duty it was to. Who would have been ready to die for you? I wonder why they should have, and why I should have asked them for that sacrifice. However, I have no doubt they would have died. Or would you have preferred me to take up my quarters on board that man's brig? We were all fairly safe there. The real reason why I insisted on coming in here was to be nearer to you to see for myself what could be or was being done. But really, if you want me to explain my motives, then I may just as well say nothing. I couldn't remain outside for days without news, in a state of horrible doubt. We couldn't even tell whether you and Delcasser were still alive till we arrived here. You might have been actually murdered on the sandbank, after Raja Assam and that girl had gone away, or killed while going up the river. And I wanted to know at once, as soon as possible. It was a matter of impulse. I went off in what I stood in without delaying a moment. Yes, said Mr. Travers. And without even thinking of having a few things put up for me in a bag. No doubt you were in a state of excitement. Unless you took such a tragic view that it seemed to you hardly worth while to bother about my clothes. It was absolutely the impulse of the moment. I could have done nothing else. Won't you give me credit for it? Mr. Travers raised his eyes again to his wife's face. He saw it calm, her attitude reposeful. Till then his tone had been resentful, dull, without sarcasm. But now he became slightly pompous. No. As a matter of fact, as a matter of experience, I can't credit you with the possession of feelings appropriate to your origin, social position, and the ideas of the class to which you belong. It was the heaviest disappointment of my life. I had made up my mind not to mention it, as long as I lived. This, however, seems an occasion which you have provoked yourself. It isn't at all a solemn occasion. I don't look upon it as solemn at all. It's very disagreeable and humiliating. But it has presented itself. You have never taken a serious interest in the activities of my life, which of course are its distinction and its value. And why you should be carried away suddenly by a feeling toward the mere man, I don't understand. Therefore you don't approve, Mrs. Travers commented in an even tone. But I assure you, you may safely. My feeling was of the most conventional nature, exactly as if the whole world were looking on. After all, we are husband and wife. It's eminently fitting that I should be concerned about your fate. Even the man you distrust and dislike so much, the warmest feeling, let me tell you, that I ever saw you display, even that man found my conduct perfectly proper. His own word. Proper. So eminently proper, that it altogether silenced his objections. Mr. Travers shifted uneasily on his seat. It's my belief, Edith, that if you had been a man you would have led a most irregular life. You would have been a frank adventurer. I mean morally. It has been a great grief to me. You have a scorn in you for the serious side of life, for the ideas and the ambitions of the social sphere to which you belong. He stopped because his wife had clasped again her hands behind her head, and was no longer looking at him. It's perfectly obvious, he began again. W. We have been living amongst most distinguished men and women, and your attitude to them has been always so negative. You would never recognize the importance of achievements, of acquired positions. I don't remember you ever admiring frankly any political or social success. I ask myself what after all you could possibly have expected from life. I could never have expected to hear such a speech from you. As to what I did expect. I must have been very stupid. No, you are anything but that, declared Mr. Travers, conscientiously. It isn't stupidity. He hesitated for a moment. It's a kind of willfulness, I think. I preferred not to think about this grievous difference in our points of view, which, you will admit, I could not have possibly foreseen before we... A sort of solemn embarrassment had come over Mr. Travers. Mrs. Travers, leaning her chin on the palm of her hand, stared at the bare matchboard side of the hut. Do you charge me with profound girlish duplicity? She asked, very softly. The inside of the deckhouse was full of stagnant heat perfumed by a slight scent which seemed to emanate from the loose mass of Mrs. Travers' hair. Mr. Travers evaded the direct question which struck him as lacking fineness even to the point of impropriety. I must suppose that I was not in the calm possession of my insight and judgment in those days, he said. I was not in a critical state of mind at the time, he admitted further. But even after going so far he did not look up at his wife, and therefore missed something like the ghost of a smile on Mrs. Travers' lips. That smile was tinged with skepticism which was too deep-seated for anything but the faintest expression. Therefore she said nothing, and Mr. Travers went on, as if thinking aloud. Your conduct was, of course, above reproach. But you made for yourself a detestable reputation of mental superiority, expressed ironically. You inspired mistrust in the best people. You were never popular. I was bored, murmured Mrs. Travers in a reminiscent tone, and with her chin resting in the hollow of her hand. Mr. Travers got up from the seaman's chest as unexpectedly as if he had been stung by a wasp, but, of course, with a much slower and more solemn motion. The matter with you, Edith, is that at heart you are perfectly primitive. Mrs. Travers stood up too, with a supple, leisurely movement, and raising her hands to her hair turned half away with a pensive remark. Imperfectly civilized. Imperfectly disciplined. Corrected Mr. Travers after a moment of dreary meditation. She let her arms fall, and turned her head. No, don't say that, she protested with strange earnestness. I am the most severely disciplined person in the world. I am tempted to say that my discipline has stopped at nothing short of killing myself. I suppose you can hardly understand what I mean. Mr. Travers made a slight grimace at the floor. I shall not try, he said. It sounds like something that a barbarian, hating the delicate complexities and the restraints of a nobler life, might have said. From you it strikes me as willful bad taste. I have often wondered at your tastes. You have always liked extreme opinions, exotic costumes, lawless characters, romantic personalities like Delcasser. Poor Mr. Delcasser, murmured Mrs. Travers. A man without any ideas of duty or usefulness, said Mr. Travers, acidly. What are you pitying him for? Why? For finding himself in this position out of mere good nature. He had nothing to expect from joining our voyage, no advantage for his political ambitions or anything of the kind. I suppose you asked him on board to break our tete-a-tete which must have grown wearisome to you. I am never bored, declared Mr. Travers. D. Delcasser seemed glad to come. And, being a Spaniard, the horrible waste of time cannot matter to him in the least. Waste of time, repeated Mrs. Travers, indignantly. He may yet have to pay for his good nature with his life. Mr. Travers could not conceal a movement of anger. I forgot those assumptions, he said between his clenched teeth. He is a mere Spaniard. He takes this farcical conspiracy with perfect nonchalance. Decayed races have their own philosophy. He takes it with a dignity of his own. I don't know what you call his dignity. I should call it lack of self-respect. Why? Because he is quiet and courteous, and reserves his judgment. And allow me to tell you, Martin, that you are not taking our troubles very well. You can't expect from me all those foreign affectations. I am not in the habit of compromising with my feelings. Mrs. Travers turned completely round and faced her husband. Why you sulk, she said. Mr. Travers jerked his head back a little, as if to let the word go past. I'm outraged, he declared. Mrs. Travers recognized there something like real suffering. Assure you, she said, seriously, for she was accessible to pity, I assure you, that this strange Lingard has no idea of. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.